Hello and welcome to episode 120 of the Building Sustainability Podcast. My name is Geoffrey Hart, and every fortnight join me as I talk to designers, builders, makers, dreamers and doers. Together we can explore the wide world of sustainability in the built environment by talking to wonderful people who are doing excellent things. Today's wonderful person is Caroline Nicolay. Caroline is a natural builder, coming at it very much from the archaeology side. I'm actually not going to say too much more than that, because she describes it so much better than I ever could in just a few moments. Today's chat was recorded in November of 2023. We recorded it remotely. We had just met up when I was cycling around Scotland. We went for a lovely, lovely cup of tea and, yeah, chatted endlessly. So I knew it was going to make a really good conversation. This chat includes talk about archaeology, materials. We go into lots of materials stuff. We go really deep in on pigment and how you can make your own pigment. We get very excited about casein paints. And then we have a big old chat on roundhouses, which follows on from the last two episodes with Adrian Lehman rather nicely, almost like I planned it. We actually spoke for 2 hours. This is only the first hour-ish. I'm slightly hesitant to put out the second hour. We spend quite a lot of time sort of pondering things that we don't particularly know the answers to. And while I personally loved it, I'm not 100% sure how useful or interesting it would be for anyone else. What I think I'm going to do is I'll pop it on the Patreon, and the good supporters of the podcast can say whether it's worthy of releasing or not. Yeah, so watch this space. Maybe it'll come out. For those interested, we spend quite a lot of time talking about chalk as a building material. We talk about earth floors. And there is some dynamite historical spoon facts, which had me beaming. Head on over to Patreon if you want to have a listen. And let me know what you think. Is it worthy of putting out? Okay, so before that, news. Friend of the podcast, Sally Coulthard, has a new book. We discussed it during our conversation. It is called A Brief History of the Countryside in 100 Objects. It's out now. There is a link to it in the show notes. I've just ordered my copy. I can't wait to get into it. I'll pop a link to Sally's episodes too. They were one of my recent favourites. Other news. Oh, Clayfest. So Ibuki, so Earth Building UK and Ireland, are hosting an in-person Clayfest again. And I shall be teaching a 2-day workshop in making earthen floors. So if you want to come along and scrape all of the earth floor knowledge from my brain, then this is the ideal way. We'll go over designing mixes, different build-ups, component parts, different installation techniques for subfloors and top coats. We'll talk oils for finishing, and we'll have loads of space to drink tea, and you can ask all the questions that come up. You'll make your own bit of earth floor to take home with you, and you'll have a go at installing on a live project, so a big floor, so you can get some experience of what it's actually like to install a large floor. If you would like, you can bring some of your own subsoil. Say if you've got a build at home going on, you can bring that soil and you can test it as part of the course. We'll design a mix together, and then you can actually lay a little bit of that floor. There is a link to that in the show notes. As of yet, I don't think the courses are up. I think they're going up next week, which will be the 20-something of March. Yeah, I hope to see you there. Okay, patrons, this month we have Sam Turner. Sam has gone for the spoon level. Sam, I will be carving you a spoon soon. I've been carving some lovely alder. Ian Dickinson upgraded himself to a spoon level too. Ian also utilised the discount code for a course at the Nettlecombe Craft School. So I look forward to greeting you here soon, Ian. And final special mention to George Harris, who I might have forgotten to read out their name. I'm very sorry about that, George. So if you would like to support this podcast, as Ian, George and Sam have done, then head to patreon.com/buildingsustainability. In return for your support, you get advert-free listening, you get bonus content and whole episodes that won't be available anywhere else. Quite possibly the second half of this conversation with Caroline. You also get 10% off all craft courses at Netcombe Craft School. So just like Ian, you could have a bit of a saving. Show notes, make sure you check out the show notes of this episode. I try to include a link to everywhere that we talk about, any books or podcasts. Sharing, please share this episode. It really helps get the word out, get people listening. If you are new here, please make sure you subscribe and go back and listen to all the episodes. There are so many great people, so much to learn, so much inspiration to be had. And the final bit of news is that I've got one more pre-recorded episode, which is with friend of the podcast and natural builder extraordinaire, Will Stanix. I'll put that one out in a couple of weeks and then I will be taking a short break. I need to get back out there and interview some more people and generally just get ahead on some things. So I will be back very soon. Okay, that is it from me. Enjoy.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Hall, host of Sustainable Futures, Kantar's regular look at the intersection between brands, consumers, and sustainability. I want to help you to get your brand ready for the future, understand where you can make an impact, and make a smarter business case for products and services that are better for people, the planet, and for business. Sustainable Futures will showcase what great sustainable marketing looks like and the issues that matter to consumers across the globe. Subscribe to Sustainable Futures from Kantar, wherever you get your podcasts.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yes, so my name is Caroline Nicolet. I mainly have an archaeology background, so that's where it all starts for me, really. I have learned archaeology, got to university, museum studies. I don't really dig. I mainly work in museums or open-air museums, their heritage sites, and as a living historian now. So I try to share what we know from archaeology with the general public, even people who don't know if they are interested in archaeology or not, or are just plain not interested, and make it understandable and enjoyable for hopefully all the visitors that turn up. So that's basically what I do.
Is that experimental archaeology?
A little tiny bit. Yeah. I'm more on the experiential archaeology. Ooh. Yes, which is really confusing. In the last few years, a lot of names like that have appeared and changed, and I could do some experimental archaeology, but I don't have problematics, I don't record results or what's going on properly, and I don't publish. So instead of running experiments properly, I'm more interested in experiencing and getting anybody to experience something from or related to archaeology. So, uh-huh. For example, dressing up as an Iron Age person, as far as we know for the moment, and cooking on an open fire in replica clay pots using ingredients of the time is one of the things I do.
Great.
And teach.
So I was looking at your website earlier. Pario Gallico?
Yes.
Is that, did, am I saying that right?
You are the first person too, so thank you. Yes.
I never normally pronounce anything right. What does that mean?
Oh, it means the Gallic cauldron in what we know of the ancient language of the Celts who inhabited France. So the Gauls. So, yeah, Asterix and Obelix, if they had existed, they would have been calling probably a tavern like that.
Oh, I see.
Because all of that started with historical food. That was my main research area and what I was doing in living history and running courses and workshops. And I switched in the last, how many years, to pigments. The question of paints in prehistory, early history, was there any? How was it made? And did they paint their walls? And from there on, so the answer is yes.
Is there dug up evidence of paint?
Yes. It's very difficult to find, so there are not much. There's not much. And I mainly work with the east of France, the northeast of France, and German finds. Mm-hmm. It's so far not really found in Britain, simply because, as many of the listeners will probably know, when you build with earth and you plaster with clay on earth and you paint with earth pigments onto a clay plaster that's on an earthen wall, and you leave it for 2,000 years in the ground, there's not much left.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is one of the sure things about clay, is that it is it sort of will return to its previous state given enough weather. So, so yes, what's being found and what... Is it just clay and pigment, or are there additives? Or
that's the major question. So focusing on painted walls, we have pieces of Iron Age, so around 5th, 6th, 8th century BC, so some time ago, about 2,000, 3,000 years ago. So we find pieces of walls. Usually, well, the ones I'm looking at, Waterland Daub, you can the house burned down at the time, so it cooked the walls with the paint, with the layers and everything. Of course, the wattle that was at the back got destroyed, disappeared, burned down, but we can find the imprints of many wooden parts of the houses, of the architecture. So that's the first really interesting thing. You can find beams, were they squared, were they round wood, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Then what interests me most is wall finishes. So you have usually between 3 and 5 layers of plasters, or render sometimes on the outside, a white, and then the paint. So it's incredibly similar to what we seem to be doing now. I'm only now getting into... I want to say modern earth building, so natural sustainable building, because I want to learn exactly how they could have done that, or they were doing that 2,000 years ago. And I want to show it to the public to be able to say, hey, 2,000 years ago, the people living in that space were really good at that. They knew how to build, knew how to make their houses. Don't listen to the Victorians. Not everybody was wearing, you know, a sort of skin on their shoulders and running around half naked after some beasts. That's usually what we picture. And on the other side, it allows me to say that in the 21st century, if you like what you see in a reconstructed ancient house, did you know that some people are professionally making this in the UK and all around the world? And quite often, the surprise is really there.
Wow. That's really interesting that you... So I spend a lot of my time looking back to see the techniques. so I can sort of bring them forwards and, you know, push, make them in, useful for a sustainable future. And you're looking at the way we have looked back, found out a little bit. You're seeing that, and then you're applying that even further back than even we could possibly sort of comprehend.
Well, put like that. Yes, probably. And I'm not going as far as some people go. I mean, Becky Little and Tom Morton, for example, at the moment, are looking at clay mortars or earth mortars and materials that you find in archaeology on the Orkneys. So it's way before my research area. It's probably 2,000-3,000 years before what I'm looking at.
Right.
So there's a lot of things, and very luckily, on the Orkneys in Scotland, they are, to my knowledge, the earliest painted walls that I've ever looked at, ever found. It's the Neolithic, so it's the end of the Stone Age, and their houses are mainly built of very beautiful stones. And very recently, at the Ness of Brodgar, they seem to have found painted potteries and painted walls, along with tools, receptacles, and mortars made of various materials with pigments still inside. So it's, for me, it's amazing and perfect. And for many people, it was a little bit of a shock to look at prehistory in a very colourful way.
Yes, I think there's that sort of film view, isn't there, that everyone's kind of covered in mud. you know, living in very dirt brown houses. And so you're saying that probably isn't the case.
Well, to our knowledge, or the very few evidence we find, there is quite a lot. And I'm only mainly looking at walls and architecture. But as soon as you look at artifacts, at objects, for example, let alone all the things we cannot look at, were they painting their clothes, for example? A lot of experimental archaeology and living historians do that now. It's very probable we are before the time of dyes to colour clothing, using usually vegetal materials, and paints are already there and have been there since the very, very beginning. Tammy Hotchkiss actually does an awful lot of research in Africa, in Johannesburg, about the use of ochres in many, many ways, including paints, and it's at least since Neanderthal. And don't ask me dates about that. I knew them at some point in my life. I can't.
Okay, I'll leave the date question.
Thank you.
So what are these paints? So if let's talk about walls, obviously. Mm-hmm. I'm a walls kind of guy. not that I don't like a bit of pottery or artifacts, but what are these paints being made from?
That's an excellent question, and that's mainly what I was trying to look deeper into. We know about the pigments, but as well as a pigment, so mineral pigments, that's a first answer. Mm-hmm. Usually have, before the Roman turns up in Britain, say Northwestern Europe and Britain, we only seem to find yellow, red, black and white. And usually yellow ochre, red ochre or hematite, which is an iron ore. So in Britain, there's lots of it. Huge amounts, tons, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. Black and white, it depends. The black is really difficult to tell because it's mainly carbon black. So it could be charcoal, burnt plant matter. It could be bone black, burnt bones. They turn into pure carbon as well. Lamp black, when you have a little fat lamp or oil lamp and you catch the soot, that makes a very, very fine black pigment. But again, it's all carbon, so we can't really, I don't think we can really separate them. I would double check with a specialist. And for the white, sometimes you find chalk, sometimes bone white, it can be crushed eggshells, seashells, things like these. But we don't seem to have any lime in northwestern Europe and the British Isles before the Romans bring it to build with stone.
Oh, really? See, because I've always had this sort of image that we built our fires and we've sort of put rocks around them, and then one day someone must have put limestone around their fire and, you know, basically turned it into quicklime, and they must have sort of seen this magical transformation, and then maybe the fire got rained on and it became this sort of sticky putty. I've sort of imagined in my head that that must have happened many thousand years ago. And so sort of lime was an understood thing for way longer than the Romans, way before the Romans, I should say.
It's a really weird thing because it's exactly that. It's most probably, well, at least to me as well, what would have happened. And there are traces of lime really quite early. I think either in Eastern Europe or Western Asia. I would love to know more about that. Mm-hmm. But as far as I can tell, or see or read in publications and analysis and all of these sort of things, we don't seem to use it, or it hasn't been found before. I usually say the conquest of Britain, but before the Roman turns up, so say the first century BC, where we are quite connected already with trade and exchange of ideas and everything like that. So I don't seem to see it. And in these pieces of burnt daub with their plasters, with their paint that we find in eastern France, in Vix, for example, in Burgundy, or the brilliant example in Venungen in Germany, that's a massive, massive wall. There are little inclusions that could have been lime, but they are chalk inclusions that burned when the house burned down and turned themselves into mini pellets of lime now. But apparently there's an analysis that you can do and you can tell the difference. You can see if it's a lime that has been, well, a limestone that has been made into lime, slaked, used, turned back into limestone, or if it's just a little piece of chalk or limestone in the mix that has been just burned down and happened to look like lime. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's incredible that you could tell the difference.
There's even a specialist in France. I'm so sorry. I forgot his name, but that's what he does.
Oh, wow. I mean, I sometimes wonder if I haven't specialised enough in building trades, but that is a very, very specialist.
There are some epic specialties in the archaeology, that's for sure.
I love it. So when you say mineral pigments, is that just a case of grinding up the iron ore? Was that right? Was it you said iron ore?
Yeah, it can be iron ore. Effectively, as long as you find something, so it can be a sand, a clay, a sandstone, semi-precious stone if you wanted to and had the money, or any mineral that you can easily either grind or rub, so polish on another harder stone with water. So a bit like if you wanted to smooth a very colourful pebble, the abrasion with the water on another stone or on some sand will create that sort of residue. That could be a pigment. It's going to take some time. The easiest would be to find sand or a clay or almost pure iron oxides, some natural rust, which we call ochres usually. Well, that's another question altogether. You can grind them and sieve them. You can also wash them. We say levigate in water. And I think it's something that, as natural builders, a lot of people already do. So when you are making clay slip, for example, you're basically making pigment. The slip is your pigment. It's just that it's a pigment that comes from clay. So you would take your earth or your sand. Oh, if you go to building suppliers, you might see different color sand, right? So you have very bright yellow one that comes from, weirdly enough, the ochre mines in France, in the Luberon. So you can get that sand, rinse it in water, say, shove it in a bucket, really stir it, or in a jar, shake the jar, leave it to settle for a few seconds. All the grit, the sand, the very heavy rocks and particles that you don't want in your paint will fall at the bottom of the jar or the bucket. Quickly, you pour the colored water that still has the very, very fine particles of color in suspension in the water. You pour that colored water in another bucket or in another jar. Leave it to settle completely, say overnight or after a few days, sometimes just a few hours. And at the bottom, you will have a layer of pure pigment, of pure color, and on the top, clear water. Get rid of the clear water, and that's it. You've got pigment. And then you can choose if you want to separate fine-grade pigment for artists or heavier grade that you can use on buildings. Frankly, I never had the time for that, so I just mix everything. Yeah. I'm painting on walls in any case.
That's fascinating, because that is what we would call a shake test.
Yes.
So when people... I'm explaining this to the people at home, by the way, not to you. I don't mean to...
No, please do. I've not done it much.
Yeah, so if we were testing a clay subsoil that we want to know what was in it, we'd put it in a jar, we'd shake it all up with water. And yes, the first bits that drop to the bottom would be the biggest biggest particle sizes, so your sands, rocks, things like that. And then we would just be setting that jar aside and letting all the layers settle over time. And then you get a little sort of picture at the bottom. So you get big aggregate, then slightly smaller aggregate, smaller, 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 until you get a sort of film of, or hopefully if your soil is clay, you get a sort of clay film on the top, and then you get your clear water. So it's fascinating to hear that process being done with a different outcome. I mean, it sort of shows you how ancient that is.
Yeah. And I was amazed the first time I've seen the shake test, because I thought, oh, excellent, everybody knows we're going to make color, we're going to make pigments. And then they never separated the jar. What's the point? I don't understand. So now I understand. Yes, that's how you test your aggregate in your soil. But
you thought, what are these stupid natural builders? They don't even separate.
Well, who's doing that anyways? But that's super interesting to me, because I know now that I can go to virtually any natural builder or people who work with clay, especially, but sand works as well. Other, you can even grind bricks or broken terracotta pots. There's so many things that are just inorganic, so minerals, that you can turn into paints. Then there's the wide question of the lake pigments, half organic, half inorganic. I am not touching this for the moment. There are professionals out there. This is another rabbit hole. But if I go to any natural builder and I tell them, when you do the shake test, wait until all the aggregates that you can see clearly fall at the bottom of the jar, and that very thin, fluey layer that you have at the top, keep it mixed within the water, pour that on the side, leave it to settle, leave it to dry, bam, you've got your pigments. So it might take some time to make enough pigment to make your own paint, but that's where clay paints come in. Yeah. clay is your pigment. So you can mix it with a binder. That's the second thing you need in a paint. You need a pigment and a binder, whatever the binder might be. Say lime, for example, lime water, lime washes, down to, for say, tempera paint, it's egg yolk, water, and a bit of pigment.
Aha. So do you know what my dad once said to me? I was experimenting with tempura. Am I saying that right?
Tempera.
Tempera. Tempura is the deep fried vegetables, isn't it?
Yep.
yeah, not that one. I was playing with tempera, and my dad kind of rolled his eyes and went, you know, like, oh, you know, what funny alternative thing are you going to come up with next? And I kind of thought, that's funny. I'd imagine, you know, quite a lot of the art that you might have seen was, you know, this sort of style of technology. And it's the sort of, you know, the modern paint idea is so modern, and so the knowledge of everything that could have come before is so lost.
Yeah, it does feel like that. And I see exactly what you mean. It happens all the time. Oh, look at these people mixing egg and colour, and they'll make a paint. Oh, it's so hippie.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So the best portrait makers, even now, the icon painters that are still in Eastern Europe, are still using tempera. The Romans used it as well, and we're pretty sure that many people millennia before the Romans used it too. It's just very easy, and the egg comes in its own little container that you can, you know, store, transport and all that. It's great.
Yeah, everyone would have a chicken, right?
Well, oh no! Well, before the first or second century BC, we don't have chicken in the UK, so it's always the answer I get in prehistory. You wouldn't have chicken.
Yeah.
And so, well, yeah.
Chickens came from, was it Asia?
Asia, yeah, you're right, yeah.
So what did we have? Ducks?
Yes. Geese, any other birds that you may find. Not turkey, they're not there yet. Still in America. not pheasants either. But a lot of wild fowl. So, yeah, if you are on the seaside, I'm thinking straight away on the islands and the Orkneys, etc. There's so much tradition of going out, even in Scandinavia, and picking up wild eggs from seabirds. Yeah, you can do that. You can use animal fats. Any complex sugars, so say honey water, that works really well. Some people paint with beer.
Pardon?
Hear me out.
My ears have pricked up.
I knew it. And I can hear the screams, whoa, it's so wasteful. And I noted.
Hey, there's a lot of terrible beers out there.
Well, that's not, yes, it really is true. It's not wrong. Yes, I've seen that in a brilliant book, I think it's just the Natural Paints book. It's just about
book.
Ah, haha! It's brilliant. There's a beer glaze in it. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and so that is the pigment collected, as we talked about earlier, mixed with any particular type of beer.
I think that was a question at some point. Do you need a bubbly beer or do you need a flat beer like some? Non-carbonated, oh, that's weird, isn't it? Non-carbonated beers or ales.
Mm.
I do not have the answers, but after thorough chats with brewers, they probably would recommend a first or a second brew, and I lost the conversation there. But they don't recommend any specific ones. So, yeah, there's lots to play with, experiment with. There's proteins work well as well, so animal glues sizes, mm-hmm. That's no problem at all. Dairy casein, everybody.
Ooh,
in the lime,
yes.
Uh-huh. Casein paint is, to me, it's the most ancient one, simply because there's one tiny shred of evidence in a painted cave in Spain. They didn't have the right to scratch the prehistoric paint from the cave to analyze it. But they were allowed to take samples around the painting, thinking there might be bacteria that have grown on whatever was the binder at the time and got mm-hmm. stuck there. Turns out, dairy product.
That's interesting.
But they don't know if it was animal dairy or human dairy. Good point.
Oh, uh-huh. I didn't consider that was an option.
No, me neither. That was a rollercoaster of an article. So there was that. And if it's dairy, is it milk? Is it butter? Like in some tribes in Africa, we still mix butter and red ochre and use it as a sunblock and it nourishes the skin, etc., etc. Or is it an animal that they hunted and specifically because they had a young and they had milk? Because it predates agriculture in the region. So who's mistaken there? Do we have agriculture before, way before the time we think? Or did they get milk in a way or another that we can't think about yet?
Yeah. Fascinating. So the paints, the milk paints that we get, milk paints kind of seen a bit of a resurgence recently. But I remember the first time you get it in a little powder and mix it up. And I remember the first time I mixed it up going, oh, what's that smell? I know that smell. And I was hit with the smell of lime.
Oh.
And so the modern milk paints are putting a little dash of lime in. And I wondered if that is to stop the milk from going mouldy when it's on the, you know, after it's been painted.
Hmm. Do you know, I should have thought about that. Because it does go mouldy.
Right, okay, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, so, I mean, I guess in our modern cultures, having a paint that goes mouldy is probably, people would turn their nose up at it.
I mean, I would. It smells like feet for a few weeks.
Yeah. I considered putting casein in one of my floors.
Oh, yeah.
And then I asked the question on online and someone said, that will smell terrible. And I realised that, you know, maybe it can take sort of a week, 10 days to dry an earth floor. That's a lot of time for some funk to build up.
Oh, yeah. But it works really well. So, oh, milk floors, no, Jeffrey. Oh, Pandora's box. But for paint.
We'll get onto that more later.
Oh, no. So I've mainly used casein paint without knowing that it was widely used like that, because I've just seen a recipe online, you know, many years ago when I typed into Google, how can I paint my Iron Age shield with different colours? Oh, casein paint. You can make it yourself. Here you go. And it very much is the principle of making cottage cheese. It's, to me at least, very simple and it has been really successful. But I've only used it on wattle and daub in open-air museums, where people have the patience, they're interested by the experiment, and nobody is going to live in the house, so you can have it for many weeks and just record what's happening. So I'm not sure if I made casein paint or a coloured mortar with casein in it, but basically you've got a volume of cheese curds that you just made. I'm not going into details right now, but there might be questions. So
I'll put a recipe, a link to a recipe in the show notes.
Yay! So a volume of cheese curds, a volume of chalk powder, and a volume of water. And you adapt to what you want to make. But basically, that was the free parts. Then you add your slaked pigment, so the pigment that you extracted from minerals that is now in a lovely powder, which is what you can buy in artist shop or construction for supplies and things like that.
Yeah.
Slake it first. So put your pigment in water, mix it, add it to the mix, you've got your casein paint. On applications, very nice, very creamy. It will dry, but it hasn't cured yet. And that's the main thing that I struggled a little bit with at the start. Yes, it will be dry, but it needs months to fully cure and kind of turn itself into a form of natural plastic, I've read somewhere. So, yes, the wool, after maybe a week, maybe two, again, you're in a house that's not inhabited, so it gets pretty damp in the winter and so on and so forth. Anyways, fuzzy walls. Yes, it did go moldy. No problem. That was different and interesting. And it does smell like feet for at least 2 weeks. But it will dry and then it will cure. And from there, no mold at all. And you can virtually wash your walls. So if you have a damp cloth and you want to clean it up, no problem. The paint is not coming off.
Wow. So how long was that curing process? Did you try sort of rubbing it off sort of at different intervals to,
I didn't. To see... I just tried at the end after many months. I think I left it for probably 3 months without touching it. But I've done that on shells because that was the first question. And it's much more transportable than houses.
Yeah.
And it's pretty waterproof. And it's perfect because on wattle and daub or on completely untreated wood and seasoned, if it's very hot outside, it will shrink a bit and crack. It shouldn't, but that's another question for natural builders. And then it comes back, and that paint just stayed on the walls. It cracks. It cracks with the walls. It cracks mainly with the wood that you leave in the sun because you forgot about it. Comes back with it when it gets a little bit damper and doesn't flake off. So I was really happy with it.
Was the cracking, would that have been a clay-based pigment?
I used different pigments. Some were clay-based and some were ochres.
And was the cracking kind of universal?
Yes. So it's mainly that the supports or the wall or the plank of wood that I was painting on was itself cracking. That pulled the paint apart.
Oh, I see. I see.
Sorry. It wasn't clear.
No. That's all good. It wasn't a fault of the paint.
No.
I see.
It was a fault of the wall, which brings, at the time, brought me the question of, is that normal? Apparently not. Apparently clay walls and plasters don't crack. So.
Oh, is that a... one of those things, we spoke about this a little bit before, there's sort of archaeologists have a go at recreating something, get a result and say, well, all clay plastered walls crack because their clay plastered wall cracked.
There has been, and there still is, unfortunately, yeah, there's a lot of that. It can be for construction or many other experiments. I just call it the immodesty of archaeology. You go, oh, well, I tried and it didn't work. So clearly, 2,000 years ago, people didn't know what they were doing and they had cracked walls and it probably was the job of women to repair the walls every 2 months. Like, well,
right.
I can tell you straight away that as a woman throughout history, or anybody for that matters, you don't have the time to play with these things. So it's going to be repairs once or twice a year when you have the time, because 80 to 90% of the population is into agriculture. And you probably should check out what 21st century people are making with clay that doesn't crack. Yes, you are. We all are. We're so excellent. But that's a super transition into, that's exactly why I dived into earth building specifically and natural building in general. One, it's super interesting, and B, from an archaeology and especially open air museums employee, worker and builder of little structures, from Iron Age houses to Anglo-Saxon or Viking halls and things like that, I couldn't understand why the construction or the maintenance of these buildings that usually have been built maybe 30 years ago or yesterday, we build some all the time. The maintenance of these structures is a very new thing in open-air museums, because after 30 years, they need maintenance. The problem is, I'll say we. I felt that we didn't have the skill set. Well, turns out we really don't have the skill set to maintain earth buildings, even if they have been very well built 30 years ago, worse if it hasn't been the case. We have lost that skill. And I didn't meet anyone around me who knew that there was a natural building, clay building scene in the UK, in Europe, in the world, you straight away connect with, oh yeah, there's people in, there's tribes in Africa, there's people in Asia, Indonesia, all around the world that still build with earth and clay. And that's, yeah, we could have a look at that. We call it ethno-archaeology. And then you Google Wattle and Daub, archaeology, clay, plasters, and you find Building Sustainability Podcast. And that's how I got into it. I found the...
Are you joking?
No, it's genuinely what happened. Some years ago, and you had an episode with Daniel Postmer and another one with Becky Little, and both of them popped up with archaeology and earth building combinations. And that's how it all started for me.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's really wonderful to hear.
And now I'm here. I cannot tell you how weird it feels.
It's a good job we've had to turn the video off on this call, because I am blushing quite substantially.
But it has been from there. I keep recommending it, the podcast, to many archaeologist friends and people who are just interested in connecting, you know, heritage skill or building skills from archaeology, history, even, you know, not archaeology, but medieval, Tudor, later time periods. We don't realize that it very much exists and expands and develops a lot in the UK and in Europe. So if you keep that concept in mind, we basically have nobody to turn to apart from other open air museums. Ethno-archaeology that's looking at remote populations in various parts of the world, and trying to mix different things and just having a play and reinventing the wheel again and again and again. And for my personal experience was Wattle and Daub. It should be simple. So clearly it is simple. You just take some clay, mix some sand, sprinkle with a bit of hay. That's how we've learned it. We've learnt it, and you slap it on the walls and it should work. In any case, there are going to be some cracks. It's normal. I have heard that sentence again and again and again from so many different people. It's normal. It will fail. It will crack. They just patched it. Though we ended up with like 2 inches, 5 centimeter cracks on the walls. This was not possible. But weirdly, not many people question it. The answer usually is, they probably had a better technique at the time, or clearly they were living in very poor conditions and they were just happy with that. And that's it. That's where it stops. So what I would like to do now is to learn much, much more earth building, starting with turf. Thank you, Daniel. For the moment, I've always wanted to do clay plasters and wattle and daub, and I ended up in turf construction and everything, which is amazing, by the way. Everybody should have a go. It's incredible. But it was quite removed from that. But that's what I want to do, learn so many different things at least a basic understanding level, and plus the plasters and then the paint further my research and what I want to portray, what I want to show people. But then go to open air museum and try to connect archaeologists, open air museums, people who are interested there with natural builders. Because I think there's so much crossover, there's so much interest from both sides that it's really, really strange that it doesn't seem to exist yet. Not much.
Yes. It's sort of like we're both nibbling at the same bit of information from different ends, aren't we?
Yeah.
I'm not really looking up to see that the others are there.
And it seems to me that there's an awful lot of effort from the earth building and natural building scene to share, to teach people, to bring people into it, if you like. But there has been quite a few times where it seems to be turned towards the industry. I love this word. We are trying to get industry. And probably everybody understand what I mean. So yeah, we're going to architects and builders and trying to get people who use gypsum and cement and all these things to try to use lime and earth and clays and so on and so forth. But the thing is, I come from completely the other side. I haven't looked, I haven't been taught anything about construction. I all learned it by doing it with other people. Sur le tas, that's my French brain clicking in. Learning on the job, that's it. But I wouldn't even dare, I haven't actually dared, apply for funding or go to courses that are maybe geared towards people who have done architecture or building in the past or have at least an understanding of it, because I'm not part of it. I don't consider myself to be part of it or to have been. There's so many people, the general public, that are super interesting, and especially in archaeology and experimental archaeology, everyone knows about earth building. Everyone knows or has heard about Waterland Daub. We just lack the skills, but people would love to learn. Actually, they are quite desperate to learn new things like that. So there's a massive space open for natural builders and earth building there. Well, in my opinion. And on the other hand, if we get better skills in open air museums, then we get better replica houses, which means the past is both more accurately portrayed, shown to visitors and school children and everybody, and it also reflects on the modern natural building scene. If they are so nice in the past, then where does this idea of, oh, it was made of earth and turf and it was black houses and smoky and disgusting and really poor and terrible conditions. Always think like that, because we have been taught and repeated that since the Victorian era. It just starts there. Everybody was building with earth. People still do nowadays, especially in Eastern Europe and Germany and Belgium, etc. But that tainted so badly the reputation of earth building that now I have heard, well, you and people on the podcast say so many times, well, my clients need convincing to put clay plasters or earth in their modern buildings, because they associate it with these kind of pejorative ideas.
Yeah.
So, if we had better skills and invited more natural builders and had modern cafes or exhibition spaces or offices even in open-air museums built in natural materials, especially with earth, thatch, timber frame and all of this, they are the same materials as the ancient houses we recreate, but in a 21st century context. So that's super interesting for the museums to show the evolution of techniques. It ticks there the box that just appeared one or two years ago. The definition of museum has changed on an international level, and it includes sustainability. They are meant to be spaces promoting and supporting sustainability and community.
Right. I had no idea.
Uh-huh. It was a great advanced, a great change for the definition, I think. So yeah. Everybody is embracing it, but not many sites or people have made the connection of sustainability doesn't mean you put recycling bins everywhere. You can look deeper and make a super connection between 2000, 1000, 100 years ago, maybe 200 or 500, you know, not many hundreds of years ago. In any open-air museums, you will have something made of earth, even if they are not archaeological buildings. Medieval cottages, Tudor houses. There's always something that you can connect with 21st century natural building. And that's where I sit.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it's often, isn't it, the sort of cafe on a on a an open air museum is quite sort of modern, and that would be the ideal place to do a natural build.
Yeah,
you know, get rid of all those sort of huge spanning steel members and just make that connection to what they've just seen in the museum.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Isn't it in... Oh, what's the name of the restaurant? Well, restaurant, big time. no, in the UK, they have... They serve chicken. Nando's.
They serve chicken. Nando. Yes.
Sorry.
Yes, Nando's. Nando's have clay plaster, I believe, in every one of their restaurants.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
And no one knows. No one's got a clue. And they don't kind of big it up or sell it as such. It's just this interesting, you know, alternative style, I guess.
Yeah. There's not even a sign or anything. I'm not sure the staff in any of the places I've ever been to actually realise or know or, well, care about it. But I've found myself just going in and going, oh, I'll look at the menu and, I'll check out your wall and then go out just to see. And there's some fantastic stuff, and it creates an atmosphere for those. So, of course, I'm, what's the word, preaching a convert. There might be another expression in English, but it's something that doesn't click at all when you're not part of the natural building scene . That's what I was trying to explain to a friend not a long time ago. If you don't know about it, you really don't know about it. Whereas if you are usually in the archaeology, history, and especially open air museum sector, you have seen it, you've heard it, and you talk about it. Wattle and daub is one of the key words. Everybody, even teachers in the UK, kind of need to teach, I think, case stage 2 or 3 children. So school kids have wattle and daub to learn.
Right.
So that's a super... That's a big thing, but it's only associated with, they were building their houses with mud and poo at the time. So, of course, they were very, very silly 2,000 years ago, da-di-da-di-da. And then you can then have a workshop, help build a house on some site with wattle and daub, and you could see it in the cafe. Or again, National Museum in Edinburgh. In the archaeology section, they have commissioned, commissioned a clay plaster to cover a massive part of the back wall. And I never realized that until I found a tiny, like an A4 sheet sign saying, well, this is clay plaster. This is there because of this and this, and he's the person who made it. And they specifically asked for it to be made like cracked earth.
Right.
To represent
the
past.
Oh, no. Uh-huh. Wasted opportunities.
Yep. And it's hidden at the back of many, many cases. So it's beautiful behind a Bronze Age or an Iron Age logboat. Superb. But a bit more explanation would be lovely. But it is in the museum.
I clay plastered the Waste Age exhibition, which was at the Design Museum, and we clay plastered all of the display boards. And I mean, they spent a lot of money on clay plastering, and they never mentioned anywhere that they were made of clay, even though, you know, it was on the theme of this is a material we could be using. And I just wandered round going like, missed opportunity. Also, why is my work not highlighted?
Well, yes, for a start. Oh no, I remember seeing the post on social media and thinking, wow, that's incredible that there's an exhibition where the key feature is clay plaster.
Yeah.
I should really visit.
Yeah.
Oh no.
And we told ourselves that when we were working, you know, 15-hour days. It's like, this is for... Yeah, the good of everyone seeing clay plaster.
Oh.
Oh, well.
I'm so shocked. How? I mean, it must have been beautiful, but oh no, that was the perfect exhibition as
yeah.
well.
Oh, well.
Well, looks like some people will need to plaster stuff for an archaeology exhibition. That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So I don't own a museum. we need to chat with other people.
Okay. Well, hang on. We'll put it out there with this podcast to all the museum owners.
Yes.
We'd love to come and plaster.
You were saying that you know... Oh, what's the name of the museum? Hertfordshire.
Oh, the Chiltern Open Air Museum.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's where I grew up.
That's the one. Yes. Oh, wow.
Yeah, my gran used to live in the next village from the museum.
Wow.
So yes, we used to go there quite a lot as children.
It probably didn't change much. Well, I wouldn't know.
Yes. Is that a sort of well-known open air museum in the...
Yes.
DM?
It's so well-known. Yeah, probably. It's pretty huge for a start.
Right.
And the historic buildings they have are really, really cool, really interesting. And they have rare breed animals. So frankly, I mean, that ticks all the boxes for me.
Great.
The sheep, goats, here you go.
I'm going.
you should. And there's living history events throughout the year. Well, at least there has been, that's for sure. And I had the pleasure of going there last winter to run a natural paints, here you go, prehistoric and historical paints course for their volunteers, for them to present it as activities for the schools, the children, the visitors, and so on, and potentially to use on their replica Iron Age roundhouse, which is a little bit old, and I think they are looking at replacing it for the moment. So they would arrive right at the right time for making something more accurate, because we have now many decades, yes, of trying to figure out what people were living in, and we have many more finds and blah de blah. So it would be not only super interesting, but I hear that there's a lot of clay and brickworks.
Yes,
around.
Lots of the Chiltern Hills is full of brickworks.
And Clayfest was potentially going to be at some point in that area. So I thought, haha, perfect opportunity. You get all the people interested in Clayfest, Ibuki, everybody, natural builders. And you've got the Chiltern Open Air Museum just there with either stuff to see, because they have cracking barns, let me tell you that. Weird things to say, but here we go. And if they ever have a new or the start of a project with an Iron Age roundhouse, I would try to get everybody in touch.
Mm.
So the Clayfest could have half a day, maybe a day, some hours, I don't know, presentation of the museum and exchange with all the people who might be there and not know much about earth buildings and vice versa.
Yeah, but yeah, so 2024... which might be when this episode comes out. I don't know yet. I think it's supposed to be Clayfest at H.G. Matthews in Buckinghamshire. So just down the road, really.
Ooh.
So let's make it happen. Let's bring our worlds together.
To my emails. yeah, that would be, to me, kind of a perfect project. They want a very well-built new thing so we can bring new archaeology and new ancient techniques.
The brand new ancient techniques.
It feels so much like that. It's so sleek and modern. It's only for architectural interior design. Yep, or making barns since 3000 BC.
this is a slightly tangential question. But I seem to remember you saying you had doubts about the sort of roundhouses, Iron Age roundhouses that we are building, whether they really look like that. Am I remembering that correctly?
You do.
Is this something that you want to stick your neck out on? It's fine if it isn't.
Oh, I can. I'm not the first one. I mean, there's so many people. Everybody I can think of working on the matter, on the subject,
yeah,
or in other countries, really is past that. It's the whole concept that the replica roundhouses, the Iron Age roundhouses that we have in many, many places in the UK, mm-hmm, are usually the same shape, the same design, and the same materials.
Yes.
Everywhere.
So do you want to describe what that sort of look is?
Yes. It's pretty round. It's a circle on the floor. So it's a circular plan, and you have usually, not often, not all the time, sorry, you usually have fairly sizable round wood posts straight coming out of the ground, and a structure, a cone of woven hazel or beams, usually coppice, so hazel, ash, sometimes birch, sometimes pine for any reason, put on top depending on what you have. So either in the walls you will find these big posts, sometimes, at least one Butter Ancient Farm, you have planks, so that's copied on Danebury Hill Fort, that's in the south of England as well. So it's all based on archaeological finds, and quite often you have very small, say 5 centimeter diameter little post holes instead of these massive posts in the ground on the walls. And when that happens in archaeology, we interpret it as, think about a big basket turned upside down.
Mm.
So your walls are all wattle with thin posts, woven hazel or branches all around. You leave a space for the door. You have a lintel and a threshold, so the circle is complete. You stick a roof on top. You thatch the roof, usually with reed, because, hey, it's the easiest and cheapest material to get at the moment in the UK for traditional construction. And you slam wattle, well, you slam daub, clay daub, without the majority of the time knowing what you're doing, on it. I can say that because I've done it. I've been there. I'm still, you know, unsure about it. Some people know what they're doing, but not many. So that kind of design comes from the fact that the first replica Iron Age roundhouses in the UK have been inspired, heavily inspired by African roundhouses.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, straight walls, da-da-da, etc. Okay, that's a possibility. The problem with that is that at the time, so I think it was in the, was it the 50s? 50s to 70s, something like that. So when they began to be made, the idea was pretty racist in any case. Who is pretty primitive populations that are still building ground and with earth that we can think about? Let's look at African roundhouses. Mm. Straight away, not the greatest. Also, the weather is kind of different. But it can be ethnoarchaeology. Great. Now, apparently the chap at the time was insisting on the fact that the walls should be much shorter than in Africa, because, of course, we don't want the houses to look too African, because, you know, our ancestors were a bit better than this, like blah de blah. So it doesn't come from a good place straight away. The problem was, the first ones of these, think about a thatched roof. If you want the smoke to go through, make a thin thatch. It filters through, dislodges all the bugs that might live in it. It fireproofs your thatch from the inside, and the smoke, the heat, and the absence of bugs makes it, keeps it really neat, really nice, and the birds don't peck it out trying to get a meal from it, mm-hmm, so you don't need any chicken wire on it, like modern cottages.
Yeah.
The problem is, at the start, they made a hole at the top of the house, thinking, haha, smoke hole. Great idea. So when it rains straight away into your fire. Okay, so problem already.
Your
precious fire that you need for, you know, warmth, light, eating, all of this, crafting. The answer was, they were quite primitive people, so unfortunately, every time it rained, well, it created a problem. And that's something I've heard 3 years ago in a conference given to school children in the UK. It's still an idea that goes around. So there is no hole at the top because every time you open the door, you create a draft. It picks up the sparks. And if the sparks fall in your thatch, then as there's a hole in the thatch, there's a draft that will just set it on fire. So at the start, the whole concept was it was very dangerous, very smoky, and majority of the time they died in fire accidents.
Wow.
So you see the immodesty of archaeology. That's, you know, we're trying to get out of it, but it has a very long-lived tradition. It's even way before the Victorians that that has been like that. So the problem we have there is that the concept, the idea was you take what you find in archaeology, a floor plan, post holes all around, and to imagine what it would be like at the time, you put straight posts, straight lines coming from the holes in the ground up, and then somehow you throw a roof on the top. Yes. But it's very difficult to find quite a lot of straight trees. In some places, yeah, can happen, no problem. In other places, you live on chalk, for example. That's where I lived just before. That's why it always bugged me. I can't make clay daub. I don't have clay on the site. And I would need to ride or walk or go really far away to find some clay. But tell you what, with chalk, you can make chalk cob. So you could do that. You could use planks instead of reed thatch on the roof. You could use straw, that's fine. You could use turf. We still do that in the UK, in Scotland, for example. Mm-hmm. They are still turf tiles, if you like. You can have an awful lot of different possibilities. Some people even thatch with bracken.
Who'd do that, eh?
Yeah, nobody. What a silly idea. So, broom, bracken, anything like that. What heather. I mean is, it's... heather thatching is beautiful.
Isn't it just?
Oh, I need to learn more about this. It never ends. But the point being, there's very little looking at what new archaeology ideas or logic is. We kept, for a very long time, recreating that pattern and just making what we considered the normal shape of an Iron Age roundhouse, again and again and again. And it's very striking to me in the UK because roundhouses, be it Iron Age or Bronze Age or earlier, it's not just an Iron Age thing. But anyway, roundhouses are very, very rare on the continent.
Okay.
I come from the east of France. So between Germany and eastern France, very similar cultures, we all build kind of the same. And when you have a circular building, it's either a very special building for any reason, usually ritual, as we say. Mm-hmm. It's a very special building. The majority of the other ones, houses, workshops, bloody blahs, are rectangular and square.
Right.
So if you read Asterix and Obelix, living in their Brittany little village of round houses, they're actually right. It's so annoying. Only in Brittany and the north of France will you find, the same as across the British Isles, round houses.
Right.
So it's super special. But when you come from where I come from, you're already stunned by the fact that they're round. They all look the same. They look really like African houses. And it doesn't match what the natural environment around them is. So I built one, so I'm to blame as well. I was part of the team, we built one like that on chalklands. So we had to import clay from Cornwall, from far away. So we used clay daub because we wanted clay daub instead of using chalk. We use very, very local coppiced hazel to make straight woven walls. But in that valley, all the trees growing around the valley are curved. Because, of course, they grow from the side of a hill and up, and then they go up towards the sun. And working with Daniel Postmer, Archaeobuild, that's very easy to use. That's how you make crook frames.
Mm-hmm.
still very much used in Scotland, the Netherlands, and many other places, even now, or even fairly recently. So, say, about 200 years ago? It's super recent. So you cut your tree, it looks like a golf club, you turn it upside down, and the two club parts meet in the middle, and you create a wooden arch. That's a really good way of making a round house with a roof that is very well maintained on the top.
Mm-hmm.
But it changes the visual, the architecture of it. So it might start like a straight post and suddenly it curves and you have effectively wooden arches all around your house. That's one other possibility. Some other people, for the moment, at the Scottish Chronic Centre, for example, Hamish... Dara, I'm so sorry, Hamish, if you ever listen to this podcast, has done a lot of experimental archaeology on these houses, and he has been commissioned to make a bigger one, and it is what I call the beehive Iron Age round house. It's round, it will be a house, but imagine it completely woven from the floor to the ceiling, like a massive basket turned upside down.
I think I've seen that.
Oh, you might have.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
It's really good. And normally it should be heather thatch, so I'm really looking forward to that, because that's a super example. Exactly what we find in archaeology. Completely different from many other roundhouses possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I would like to see more of. There's also a lot of little differences and things that could make them more livable, warmer, easier to use, more accurate probably. So for example, the connection between the wall at the top of the wall and the lower part of the roof, mm-hmm. Well, you usually have about 20 centimeter gap there. And usually people don't feel that gap because they are copying that model. Problem is, if you don't fill it up, there's a little bit of a draft, so the smoke from your fire, instead of going up and through your thatch, is suddenly getting stuck at head level.
Mm.
So suddenly you might think, or you might present to people, round houses that were definitely very smoky at the time. No, they weren't. We're just not building them right. It's so annoying. And then, you know, birds and mice can get into your house, the hot air gets out. It's not very practical. So there's a lot.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Yes. Thank you, Caroline. That was so good. You could hear me chuckling away throughout that, I'm sure. Very, very enjoyable. Thank you, Caroline. If you enjoyed that episode, there is a whole nother hour with Caroline over on the Patreon page, patreon.com/buildingsustainability, or link in the show notes. Speaking of links, there is a link to Becky Little, her website, and the Building Sustainability podcast that she did. There is a TEDx talk with Tammy Hodgkiss, a link to the Natural Paint book. Can't recommend that enough. really, really good if you are interested in making your own paints. Loads and loads and loads of recipes. I have included a casein paint recipe and also how to make casein recipe. There is a link to Daniel Postma, his episode of Building Sustainability Podcast, and his website. There is a link to Clayfest. Come along and learn earth floors with me, or learn other exquisite clay things with other great people. There is a link to the Scottish Crannog Centre Beehive. Really just, so many great things going on at the Crannog Centre. Worth a look. That is about it from me. Just time to say, please do subscribe and check out other episodes. Please do share if you've enjoyed this. It really helps to get the word out. If you really, really enjoyed this, consider becoming a patron. You get all the bonus stuff. I think it's about 11 hours worth of bonus content. And you might get a spoon if you want a spoon. Okay, that's it for me. I'm knackered. I'm going to bed. Thanks, everybody. Be back soon. All the best.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Hall, host of Sustainable Futures, Kantar's regular look at the intersection between brands, consumers, and sustainability. I want to help you to get your brand ready for the future, understand where you can make an impact, and make a smarter business case for products and services that are better for people, the planet, and for business. Sustainable Futures will showcase what great sustainable marketing looks like and the issues that matter to consumers across the globe. Subscribe to Sustainable Futures from Kantar, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.